Here is a new word for you, somatology. And it might actually be one we've made up, but we say it is the art and science of what really goes on when world leaders meet face to face at those high stakes summit. And this Friday, all eyes are on Alaska, where Trump and Putin will finally sit down together again. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe and I'm looking after the place while Ciara Doherty enjoys a few well-deserved days off. But it is business as usual here on the podcast. And today we're asking, what actually happens when leaders like Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin get in the same room? How much of it is theatre? How much is deal-making? And what goes on in the corridors and the back rooms of power? And of course, this week, what's at stake for Europe, Ukraine and the rest of the world? And joining me now is Seán Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews, who's covered more summits and high-level diplomacy than most of us have had hot dinners. Seán, good to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks, Sean.
So look, you've been at tons of these things. There's been a few we've been at together at various times. So when you think of the big high-stakes summits, of the ones you've covered, what stands out in your mind as, oh my God, that was a big one, or that's one that will always stay with me?
Well, I mean, there's been several ones that have been sort of negotiations have gone down to the wire, where things were just almost cliff edge. And I'm thinking about Brexit summits. I'm thinking about the times during the banking debt crisis in 2008, when you go to the EU summits. And although the EU member states would generally pre-negotiate most things on the agenda, the news was moving faster than member states could even handle. And negotiations were so tense and so deeply consequential for the future economies of certain countries, but also of the European Union and at times the euro currency, that they would go on until 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And finally, an agreement would be made. And so when we had some of those going on at times of just huge turmoil, I suppose they were the most critical ones, because as I said, most of these things are pre-negotiated beforehand. But of course, Brexit was another one, because remember, when the UK voted to leave the EU, they didn't have a preordained idea of what that would look like. And then you had so much infighting between parties within the UK, whether it's Labour and the Tories, and then within the Tories themselves. And then some of what the UK wanted was no way coinciding with what the EU could offer. And those meetings went down often to the wire, and fairly often without any sort of results. So it's high stakes things. And we've been kind of used to that over the past, well, since the banking debt crisis, I'd say, where summits are actually that critical. They're not just signing off on something. They're not just a sort of meeting to put a signature and a photograph and then we move on. Often they're just so consequential, and then they require even more negotiations. And then when you look at what's happening with the likes of Donald Trump, it's totally different again, because you have a political actor, a partner who is quite mercurial and unreliable. And even he might say something, you might agree with him one moment, and 2 weeks later he's changed his mind and you find out about it on Truth Social.
We've become a little bit used to them as well. I mean, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, yep. A lot of the language was often the same. And if you think about the Chequers meeting, for example, between him and Leo Varadkar, that's one that always stands out in my mind. But for you who's covering it and you're on the ground, because you've got what happens in the meeting, like you say, a lot of it preordained. Then you've got the statements that come out afterwards. And then you've got what actually happened in the room. How difficult is it in real time to sort of parse all those together while also finding out, okay, here's the sanitized version. Here's what they said in the press release. What did they really say behind closed doors?
Well, you find that out afterwards when you speak to your sources, because often, you know, in cases of Brexit, there were often situations where the two sides wouldn't have a statement together. Most times it's normal that every time there's an agreement, you have a statement that is issued by both sides confirming what they have both agreed for the press and also reaffirming what was decided. And with Brexit, there was often occasions where there was no joint statement because they actually hadn't agreed anything. And then you will hear from officials from both sides, the EU, for example, saying, well, the UK arrived. They had these notions about saying that they wanted to have full access to the EU single market, but not abide by EU's regulations and not allow for freedom of movement of Europeans. And that obviously was just off the wall, because we're not going to change the single market for the UK. And then you have the UK sometimes saying, well, the EU is imposing all these checks on us and we never agreed to it, even though it's there in black and white. And we've been talking about checks for the last 4 years. So sometimes the sides are so far apart as well that it's quite astonishing. that there was even a meeting, because there's nothing that compares that is actually, speaking of the same hymn sheet. So those are the ones that are. And then there's also events that, like, for example, if you look at the last NATO summit in July in The Hague, I mean, that wasn't a very, extraordinary summit in terms of what was agreed, because it was very much preordained in terms of the 5% expenditures on defence. But you had the likes of Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, calling Trump daddy, which everybody just thought, OK, that's sycophancy. But it's also really a surreal moment that the Secretary General of NATO is saying that to the United States president. But then everybody agrees, well, that's actually how you need to talk to Trump. So are we in this completely strange world that that's how you speak to the president of the United States? And then also you had Donald Trump on the plane on the way over to The Hague questioning whether he supported Article 5 in NATO, which is literally the backbone of NATO, which is an attack on one is an attack on all. And if you're questioning that as the president of the United States, then NATO doesn't exist anymore, because it means that if Putin decides to attack any of NATO territory, Lithuania, Estonia and the smaller Baltic countries, then the United States and NATO may not come to the rescue, which means that, you know, Putin can continue his full-scale invasions, his territorial conquests unabated.
Mm. So with most other world leaders, and I imagine most of the summits that you have covered over the years, there was what the leaders said, then there was the people who are kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes, who, like your sources that you've described there, the people who know the detail maybe more intimately that you get talking to afterwards. Has Donald Trump kind of flipped the script on that, though? Because no one quite knows what he's going to say in the room. Sometimes we don't ever know what he actually said inside, because he doesn't even bring his advisors in with him.
Yeah, and actually, it's a very important point, because remember the most recent negotiations between the EU and the United States on trade, where nobody knew what was going to happen at any moment. Also, moreover, the negotiations with the EU's Trade Commissioner, Mara Šefčovič, with his counterparts, whether they're Jamieson Greer and Howard Lutnick, who were responsible for trade in the United States, they were doing negotiations. And then Trump, and then they couldn't really confirm or sign on the dotted line because it was down to Trump. And he really has this sort of imperialistic system where he will decide on a whim what tariffs will apply and what he's going to get annoyed about, whether it's access to the EU's market for US firms on agriculture, whether it's cars. I mean, that's the other thing. He tends to respond in a more emotive way. For years, for decades, Donald Trump has been talking about why are there so many German BMWs, Mercedes on the streets in New York and very few American cars in the EU. And a lot of this is due with the size of the engines and so on. They're just far too expensive to run. And so no amount of tariffs is going to make Europeans buy these cars. Donald Trump has had this sort of in his head for so long, and tariffs are something that he's always thought was the right way of, improving US access to the European markets. So no matter what was negotiated with Šefčovič and his counterparts, if Donald Trump wasn't in the mood for supporting it, then it didn't really matter. And for example, then when they thought there was a 10% deal, just a few weeks ago, there was a sort of an agreement that the US had 10% tariffs on EU goods. 2 minutes later, Donald Trump rips up the deal. And then 2 weeks later, they agree 15%. And then even now that 15% has been agreed on tariffs, everybody's saying, well, what happens if we wake up one morning and on Truth Social, he's decided to apply 50% tariffs? So these deals are in no way secure. They're just sort of day to day.
Yeah. Just briefly before we move on to the Putin-Trump summit, bring us inside the working conditions of the journalists at the summit, because having done them, you get very little sleep, it's long hours, and the food, well, it's often iffy.
That's true. But, you know, the thing about these summits is that it's the weeks beforehand that are the most crucial about gathering information about how negotiations are evolving, because of the fact that it's a lot of it's preordained. But a lot of the legal work has to apply and a lot of the political negotiations have to take place. So let's say if you're talking about the Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Zelensky issue that's happening on Friday, the meeting happening on Friday, one of the real problems with trying to ascertain what can happen here is that nobody knows what Trump is willing to do for Ukraine, because everybody has seen that for the past 6 months, he's sort of oscillated between being extremely tough on Ukraine and siding with Vladimir Putin to then applying tariffs on India for secondary sanctions against using Russian oil, and then also threatening tariffs against Putin. So nobody knows what mood he's going to be in. And so it's the lead up to all of this that is so important. And then when the summits happen, you kind of get a press statement and you write about it in that way. And it's the days afterwards then that you talk to your sources and you sort of have a bit of a debrief and you can say, well, this is what happened in the room.
So why?
And yes, the food is often iffy, very iffy. Or non-existent, actually, I would say. Non-existent.
Yes, you need the power bar in your handbag without any doubt. To build on that point that you made about the Zelensky-Putin thing, because it was, we all remember the White House encounter with Zelensky. Yeah. He then seemed to sort of shift back to putting the blame onto Putin and getting frustrated with Putin. And there is a sense that heading into this meeting, this is Putin's chance to get him back on side, that Vladimir Putin is not going to concede anything. There won't actually be any progress made towards peace, but that he might reset Donald Trump to his natural inclination of being Ukraine skeptic.
I mean, I think he hasn't gone too far away from Putin. He's just extremely frustrated that Putin has put him in this position where he hasn't been able to end the war in 24 hours or anything close to it. Like, the Ukrainians have given in on everything. They've given in on the critical minerals deals. They agreed to an unconditional ceasefire. They've agreed to negotiations. They've agreed to a setup, which is actually quite farcical, where it's Putin and Trump having a negotiation on Friday without Zelensky, which is actually just quite humiliating. It's because it's supposed to be nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. So Zelensky has said, we will do everything. And even when Putin agreed to a sort of momentary ceasefire, within hours of agreeing to that, he'd killed dozens of Ukrainians in Kyiv and all across eastern Ukraine. And every time Putin has a phone call with Trump or even Witkoff, his envoy, in the immediate aftermath, you hear all these positive words. We had a great call, we had a good call. We heard people like Steve Witkoff saying, you know, Putin is actually a nice guy. He sent over a portrait of Trump and he said he prayed for him when he was there was an attempted assassination at his rally. And then hours later, after they have these glowing words about Putin, Putin then attacks more Ukrainian civilians, whether it's a maternity hospital or a, you know, nursery or, you know, a children's cancer ward. And then they kind of look like they have egg in their face. So they're frustrated by that. But that doesn't mean the inclination to be pro-Putin and anti-Zelensky has gone away. And you're right. Putin just needs to get Trump back on his side and say, well, look, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. But he's not actually even saying that. He's saying, I'm willing to do some sort of a land swap. But the likelihood is, the fear is that the deal will just be so bad and so weak that Zelensky will have no choice but to refuse it. And then Putin and Trump and the White House can turn around and say, oh God, those Ukrainians, they're ungrateful and they're hostile to peace and there's nothing more we can do. Because remember, that's what Rubio and Vance have said in the past few months. We'll try our best, but if this is not working out, we have to walk away. And that's the real fear.
Yeah. They obviously have a history and a checkered history when it comes to their meetings in the past, and particularly the criticism that Trump had of the US security services after 2018 in Helsinki, and basically buying hook, line and sinker the line that Putin hadn't interfered in the 2016 election. Mm. That meeting in particular is interesting because they met alone, but with translators. And Donald Trump took the notes from the translator and swore him to secrecy as well. Which has led to conspiracy theories, of course, down throughout the years. Is Trump a Russian asset? Like, do you buy any of that? Or do you think this is a guy who's just a little bit enthralled or a little bit overmatched diplomatically when he meets someone like Putin?
I mean, I have this conversation all the time with Russians, you know, Russians who are dissidents and so on, and whether they know what's going on within the Kremlin, if there's anyone that might take advantage of Putin or try to assassinate him like Prigozhin did, is he an asset? And nobody knows the clear answer. We had those tapes before from Christopher Steele, a former agent who said that there was a compromat, which is regular for the Kremlin to do. Basically, they spy on a particular politician or a famous person and they create a compromise data, which means that they're enthralled to them forevermore. Otherwise, they'll publish them. So there's lots of talk about a compromise. But actually, I think it's moreover, the thing is that Donald Trump just really likes strong, hard men who have no regard for humanity or no empathy. People like Kim Jong-un as well, who he said he's admired in the past, who he had a strong meeting with, who talked about in glowing terms after their meeting. And Putin is one of them. And Putin is such a hard person. I mean, he's a dictator. He's been a dictator for over 20 years. He's taken complete control over Russia. And he also fooled the West in so many ways. I mean, look at what Germany has done over the past couple of decades, made itself very dependent on cheap Russian gas and oil. Even when Putin was taking over Georgia, you know, South Ossetia, Crimea and other parts of the world, engaging in interference, not just in the United States, but hybrid attacks all across Europe, whether it's cyber or election interfering. And yet the West, particularly the European countries, still decided to do business with Putin and refused to give strong sanctions against Putin when he invaded Crimea because they didn't want to rock the boat. So Trump obviously admires that hugely. And Putin did a really good job of it. And I mean, obviously, and he's a former KGB man. He's a former KGB operative. And so he knows exactly how to fool people and how to bring them in through flattery. And as we know, and we saw what from Mark Rutte and other people, Trump really reacts well to flattery.
He saw the former French leader François Hollande saying this week that Putin's technique is professional lying and that his strategy is to retell the stories, that he'll basically make this a long negotiation. He'll retell everything at the start, essentially bore Trump with the details and then come out with something he can claim as a win.
That's actually, I mean, that sounds right. If in the days up to leading the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, you saw Putin regurgitate some of the language he said about Ukraine before, but also he gave these long winding speeches about how Ukraine isn't a real country and how it was set up by, you know, the European Commission or basically European entities to go after Russia, also attacking NATO, saying that NATO is really just a NATO expansion has been a real threat to Russian territory. We've heard all this before. And if you speak to any countries like Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, they're the countries at the front line, at the border of Russia, who have in living memory, the memories of horrifying occupation and repression from the Soviet Union, people sent to Siberia to die and so on, rape, torture by Soviet forces. Those countries wanted to join NATO after they were liberated from the Soviet Union because they wanted forevermore to have security from the United States and throughout the West. Nothing to do with NATO trying to expand to take over Russia or to be a sort of offensive organization. Putin sort of puts it in a different way. And you hear Trump sometimes parrot that at times. And that's obviously concerning because America is in NATO.
Mm. The location of this meeting, Alaska, former Russian territory bought by the US, do we read anything into it being there?
Well, I mean, it depends what you ask. I saw an interview the other day with John Bolton, the former national security advisor for Donald Trump, who said this is the closest thing to Moscow as you could have for Putin because it's former Russian territory. And you see some of the social media from Russian accounts showing the Russian influence architecture in Alaska, Russian churches and so on. So that it's a sort of a foreign territory of Russia in making that sort of implication. Other people will say, well, they couldn't have it in Europe because of the International Criminal Court arrest warrant for Putin. But if I think that he could have had it in somewhere like Geneva, and I think they could have done it for a specific moment if they thought that there could be a chance that there would be an outcome of this.
So to wrap it all up there, and Shona, I mean, it sounds like you're pretty sceptical there will be anything here that will be positive for Ukraine out of Friday's meeting.
There is a whole week of negotiations ongoing. For example, on Wednesday, you have a phone call with Trump and Rubio and EU leaders, as well as Mark Rutte. Then you have, on top of that, other leaders from the rest of the coalition of the willing, as well as the EU and NATO. And then you also have meetings with Zelensky on top of that, with those groups. And then you have Trump and the EU leaders without Zelensky. The Europeans are trying to put a lot of pressure on the Americans to say you cannot have a negotiation with Putin and just show the Ukrainians what they're willing to give. We need to have a ceasefire first and then negotiations around what could be, you know, land swap and so on. But the fear is that on Friday, Putin and Trump will basically look at the map of Ukraine, get their pencils out and decide, you know, what they're willing to present to Zelensky. So it's a fait accompli to Zelensky. And as I said earlier, then Zelensky will see something that it's impossible for him to agree to, which will be essentially surrender. And then it will be the Ukrainians that will be seen as ungrateful. And the Americans then could say, well, you are ungrateful. We're not going to support you anymore militarily. Putin has been demanding as part of his concessions that that's been limited by the United States, that they give less military equipment to Ukraine. So Ukraine is really on its knees here. And I don't think anyone is optimistic that Trump is going to try to push Putin in any way that will be advantageous to Ukraine or see Ukraine as victorious. And remember that Ukraine has been in this situation so many times before. When it became independent in the 90s, it gave up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees. That we had the Budapest Memorandum, we had the Minsk Agreement. There have been so many occasions where Ukraine has been given these security guarantees and they fell apart at the first test. And so obviously they're extremely wary and they're obviously going through a really tough time. They have very limited resources when it comes to men and women fighting on the battlefield. You've got a very tired military. You've also got the fact that they're quite demoralized about what's happening over the past few months, that the United States has taken such a 180 when it comes to supporting Ukraine, because under Joe Biden, you had full square support for Ukraine. And now, obviously, we have under Trump, much more skeptical, much more pro-Putin. So I think that, yeah, the expectations are very low. Expectations are that Trump will take Putin's line if it's just the two of them on their own in Alaska, and then they'll present to something Zelensky just can't possibly agree to.
Yeah, to be a fly on the wall for that one. It'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
Alaska. Shona Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews. Thanks so much for joining us on News Talk Daily. Really appreciate having you on to digest all of that and the many various angles. Thank you for listening to News Talk Daily as well. We're back with another episode, of course, this time tomorrow. And don't forget to subscribe on the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud, or wherever it is you get your podcasts.